Hey, everybody. Woo. Everyone can hear me okay?
Yep.
Fantastic. I am so excited to see so many people here to talk about young adult fiction and science fiction, both big passions of mine. Yes. Give it up, Nerd Power.
Hey, you guys.
So my name is Maya Escobar, and I'm the Teen Services Librarian for the Cambridge Public Library. I do hope that you can come by and see that wonderful space sometime. And I am thrilled to be here today with Alexandra Coates, Lissa Price, and Jessica Corey, who will be discussing science fiction in young adult fiction. So without further ado, I will introduce our panelists. Oh, housekeeping before we start, obviously the phones off, vibrate, disapparate, however you like. There will be books available for signing after this event. You can meet our lovely authors and speak to them. And after our general sort of panel discussion, we will have some time for questions from the audience. We will have handheld mics going around. Please make sure when you are asking your question that you do speak into the mic, because we are recording this for posterity. And we want to hear what you have to say. So without further ado, I will start here with Alexandra, who is the author of Tumble and Fall, as well as a playwright and a graduate of NYU's Tisch School of the Arts, where she received an MFA in dramatic writing. A Boston native, Ms. Coates lives on Martha's Vineyard, which is also the setting for Tumble and Fall, and where she runs a skateboarding camp. I mean, not many people get to say that.
It's very rare that my husband is actually here, but he is here, and he knows that I do not run the skateboarding camp.
You, come on, own it.
I do. I do a lot of paperwork.
And next, Lissa Price is the author of Starters and the forthcoming sequel, or is it a prequel?
It's a sequel,
Enders. Starters is now out in paperback. She is no stranger to the sci-fi genre. She has spoken at panels at Comic-Con, WonderCon, WorldCon, Workstock, the LA Times Festival of Books, and many more. She's also a member of the Apocalypses. I don't know if you guys know about this fantastic group of YA authors, debut YA authors, the Apocalypses. And after traveling the globe, she now makes her home in Southern California and drives a lot. And last but not least, Jessica Corey, the author of Origin and Vitro, is the new book, who began writing fan fiction at a very, very young age, four, I believe,
yes.
Right? Yes. So early on, getting into the sci-fi genre. She hails from, is it Toka?
Tocoa,
Georgia.
Everyone calls it taco, but yeah, whatever works.
And you also direct theater and
yeah.
coach soccer
yeah.
and love Doctor Who.
Love Doctor Who. That's an understatement. Whovian for life.
I'm Generation Baker. So
that's okay, I forgive you.
I'm trying
Tenant.
To like
Tenant.
So start off, if each of you would like perhaps to give a brief description of your book, you may choose to begin by saying in a world or not.
In a world.
Like. But you know, give us a quick hit of what your books are about.
Oh, they're looking at me, I guess. Yeah. I mean, I go first.
Okay. You're right by her. So
in a world called Earth. Bet you never heard of it. Origin is about a 17-year-old girl named Pia, and she has lived her entire life in a laboratory in the Amazon rainforest. So it is set in our world, but it's kind of a world that maybe not all of us have really had a firsthand experience of. So she's lived her entire life in the jungle, and she was raised in the secret laboratory there, and she's been genetically engineered to be immortal based on this flower that grows only in the Amazon rainforest in this one glen. So her entire life, she has been training to become a scientist like the scientists who created her, because she's the only immortal person there is, and her greatest fear is that one day everyone she loves is going to die and she's going to be left alone. So she wants very much to help create another immortal person so she won't have that loneliness. But then things start to change. The night she turns 17, she sneaks out of the lab for the first time and starts exploring the jungle and literally runs into a boy named Io, who was raised by a nearby village. And so she keeps sneaking out to meet Io, and they kind of start falling in love. And they're, yeah. So like imagine like a young Tarzan, that's him. He's my jungle boy. But then they start to discover the secrets of how Pia was created and exactly how the flower works to make her immortal. And the secrets behind that change everything. And she has to make a very difficult decision based on that truth. So, Vitro, which comes out in January, is a companion novel to Origin. It's not the same characters, but it is set in the same universe and is about a related project, science, kind of freaky science project. So, yes.
So, in a world, in a future Los Angeles, desperate teens are renting out their bodies to seniors called Enders so they can be young again temporarily. But one senior plans to do more than party. When she's in the body, she plans to murder somebody. So this is all told from the point of view of my main character, Callie, who's 16, who is a girl who has survived the Spore Wars. The Spore Wars happens before the book begins, but basically deadly spores were unleashed, and the government did give everybody a vaccine, but they didn't have enough for the whole population. So they said, okay, we'll do a triage system, and only the very young and the very old can get the vaccine first because they're the most vulnerable members of society. And what happened was it was a killer spore, so that meant that it wiped out all of the parents. So that is the world. It's a world of elderly grandparents and young teens and young kids, of course. And so because of the no work laws, the seniors are able to vote, the teens aren't, so they voted so that the teens can't have jobs because people were living longer, they needed their jobs, some of these older people. And so Callie is stuck there with no grandparents to go live with. She didn't want to be put into an institution, and so she's squatting in abandoned office buildings with her younger brother Tyler, who's sick. And she hears about this place called the Body Bank, Prime Destinations. You can go there and rent out your body for 3 rentals, and you'll get enough money that you could rent an apartment like for 2 years. And she goes and does it, and the first time it's fine, second time it's fine. It's just like being asleep. And the third time she wakes up in the middle of her rental period in the life of her rich renter. Instead of waking up in the lab, she's in a mansion in Beverly Hills. And she is dating, the senior set this up, she's dating this gorgeous guy named Blake. And so she wants to get the money to her brother, and she starts to hear this voice in her head that says, whatever you do, don't go back to Prime Destinations, it's deadly. And it turns out that's the voice of her renter talking to her. So she can't go back there, she's stuck in the middle, and before you know it, she finds out about this plan to kill someone, so she's trying to stop it. And the person that the renter wants to kill is Blake's grandfather, who's a senator. So, and after that, those of you that have read it know there's sort of twist after surprising twist, and kind of the message is, you know, don't trust anybody, especially yourself.
Okay. Well, in a world called Martha's Vineyard, which is the world that I live in every day. I had a lot of research to do, a lot of world building. My book, Tumble and Fall, does take place on Martha's Vineyard. It is sort of very contemporary in its setting and characters. There is not a lot of, there's no experiments, there's nothing like that, but there is an asteroid. And the asteroid is coming in 5 days. So most of my world building was very sort of internal and thinking about, I have 3 main characters, Sienna, Caden, and Zan, and we alternate hearing from each of them and following them as they sort of race the clock to answer whatever questions are unanswered and try to sort of have some last adventures in what they think will be their final 5 days. Pre-asteroid.
We were talking a little bit before we got going here about how both the YA category, YA fiction, and also science fiction have something in common, which is that they often are maligned by the literary crowd as not being real writing. Obviously, I don't think this is true, but you all seem very confident both about writing science fiction and about writing for the teen audience. I wonder, was this something that you elected to do? Did either of these things catch you by surprise to find out, my God, I'm writing a science fiction novel? Do you want to speak a little bit more about why you chose to write this particular type of book for this particular audience?
For me, it was kind of an accident. I didn't really think about genre. When I came up with the idea for Origin, it was very, very sudden. It was kind of a bolt of lightning inspiration moment where I was out taking a walk, and I just started with an image just came into my mind of a girl trapped by glass walls, surrounded by jungle, and her name was Pia, and that was all I knew, but I was so entranced and intrigued by her, I had to know more, and so I kept asking myself questions. You know, why is she in the jungle? Why is she crying? Why is she special? And it all just came together in about 5 minutes. I turned around, I ran home, and I started writing the first chapter of Origin that day, and I was so in love with the story, I couldn't stop writing, and I finished it a month later, which is really, really fast for me, because the book I wrote before that took 4 years. So I was like, what is happening? I don't even know, but I can't stop. And so I got to the end of the book, and I was just kind of like out of breath. I'm like, I don't even know what this is. And I didn't really know if it was just a thriller or if it was sci-fi. And so I asked my agent, and she's like, it's sci-fi. I was like, okay, thanks. Before that, I had never actually written a sci-fi. I always wrote fantasy. But I grew up reading a lot of sci-fi. I love Ender's Game, and I love, you know, a lot of the classic sci-fi novels. And so I grew up on that, and so it was kind of just a natural thing for me to do. And so I was like, okay, it's sci-fi. And to me, I never looked at that as not being literary or, you know, I think that it was something I loved. And that was what was important to me, you know. And I think it's becoming a lot more acceptable. You know, if it's what people love to read, then that's what I'm going to write.
So. Margaret Atwood finally came forth and owned it. Right?
Yeah. Yay, Margaret Atwood.
Right. Yeah. Mine came about organically as well. I wanted to get a flu shot a few years ago, and so I went to Costco. Do you guys have Costco here? Okay. So you know it's very dystopian, you know, gray, long lines, you know, kind of thing. And then I find out, I'm halfway in the line, I find out there's been a shortage because some of the batches were spoiled in the pharmacy, and so there's not enough for everybody. So there's a triage system, and guess what? Only the very young and the very old are going to get the shot that day. So I'm huffing, but then I think, wait a minute, where's the logic in this? Because if this had been a killer flu, then that means the only people left alive, right, would be the very young and the very old and the most vulnerable members of society. What kind of world would that be? And I thought, yeah, what kind of world would that be? That's a story. That's a story I want to do. You know, and I saw a vision of a sea of white-haired people and one lone teen, you know, smaller, shorter than everybody else, like, making her way through there. And so that's what I did in Starters. I made it so that as a badge of honor, the enders, the seniors, are not dyeing their hair. So they have white or silver, glorious hair. So I read across the board, so I read a lot of different kinds of books, literary, you know, what we know as traditional literary, and science fiction, but I was reading a lot of YA. I was attracted to reading a lot of YA before I wrote this story. So Scott Westerfeld, and I love Catherine Fisher in Carceron. That's a great, great series they're making into a movie. Hugh Jackman has the rights to that book. So it was sort of really natural to me. And I think now some of the most exciting science fiction writing is taking place in the YA world.
I would definitely agree with that. I feel a little bit like an imposter sitting here because I don't think that I really write science fiction. And there is definitely, I did a lot of, you know, science research for the for Tumble and Fall, for the asteroid stuff, but I love science fiction, and I think especially in the YA world, I don't feel that it's maligned at all. I mean, I feel like it's really where all the cool stuff happens. So I feel very cool to be sitting here today. And yeah, I mean, I think in terms of where the inspiration for how my book sort of ended up, maybe hopefully a little bit science fiction, is that I just knew that I wanted some sort of very high stakes scenario under which a whole population of people would be forced to confront their biggest fears, or, you know, something that really put a time crunch on everything. And an asteroid worked. And it was really, really freaky to do a lot of the research. So I'm glad that I ended up there.
Yeah, I read one's coming like in like 2029 or something.
Yeah, Neil deGrasse Tyson's like, it's coming.
Yeah, it is. Well, the creepy thing is that they keep coming, and then they come around, and then scientists are like, yep, that one, it was, you know, nothing happened this time, but next time it's going to be huge.
I feel like they always tell us after it went
right,
by,
yeah.
too.
Like, it just
oh, we almost died. Right. Like, we almost all got wiped out.
I guess there's really no point.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Well,
getting
that's
all worked out.
That is what I was thinking. I know. Well, yes, it seems. I mean,
only 500 million miles.
So it's a scary world to look into. I don't recommend it.
So speaking of deep, dark fears and the big questions, I think that's one of the things that science fiction does so well, is that it makes us think about some of the most parts of us that make us human. And I think also young adult fiction and that time of life is when you're starting to confront a lot of questions of morality and your own existence, and you guys all have a common thread running through your books, which is ending and death and aging. Would you want to talk a little bit about how, I mean, I obviously didn't all plan to do that together, but but I just found that really profound when I was reading all your books, to think like, wow, like this is really critical, this is important, thinking about like dying, and I think you do think about death in a different way when you're a teenager versus when you're a kid or an adult.
Oh, definitely. I think it, you know, when you're a teenager is when you really start to come to face with that. I think as children, we kind of have this sense of invulnerability, where death is kind of this abstract concept we maybe don't understand, and unless we have, you know, a close family member pass mm-hmm. away. And for Pia in the book, she's kind of facing the opposite of that, which is looking at forever. And, you know, immortality is something that's most often dealt with in a paranormal or a fantasy setting. And so I thought it'd be really interesting to look at it, you know, kind of from a scientific standpoint. What if we could make people immortal? And how far would you go to make that happen? What would you sacrifice to live forever? And these are the questions Pia has to ask herself and answer in order to continue. So I think, you know, it was a really fascinating subject for me, and there were points in the book where I just had to ask myself those questions, and it, you know, caused me to look inward and be like, what would I do if I was in her shoes? I don't know if I could, you know, make these same decisions. Like, this is scary stuff. and you're right. That is a common thread through all our books. I was thinking
funny.
About that.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of times when we come up with a story, we're not necessarily going, oh, it's going to be a theme about aging, and
right,
you know,
right.
We're sort of just inspired by some story trigger. But then in the writing process, and I'm sure there's a lot of writers in the audience, you move back and forth, right? You have to be in the character's head. The more you can sort of get inside their skin, it's almost for me like an acting exercise. That's how I sort of approach writing. And so I'm in her skin trying to let the reader know what this feels like. You know, what does it feel like to risk your body, to let it go and let somebody else have it? You know, what kind of choices would you make? And that's pretty much how I work in and out.
Yeah, I mean, I think in my case, I was writing in a very real world, in a very real setting that I was seeing every day. but I was, you know, under this, I had created this sort of false circumstance of the asteroid coming. So I was constantly saying, like, you know, if I, whatever character I was writing, you know, how would this person's life, what is the world that makes up their individual life every day? And how would that be different if they knew they only had 5 days left? And I think, you know, it's so interesting to think about teenagers and immortality because, you know, I think I still most of the time think I'm going to live forever, to be honest, but I definitely did when I was a teenager. And then this other side of it, like, do you really want to? When it's the opposite and you know that there are only 5 days left, I think I ended up with all three characters was sort of that they didn't have time to think about that. They didn't have time to think like, well, especially when they were hearing reports of, you know, this is what's going to happen. First, there's going to be a huge tsunami, and then, you know, you're going to be completely washed away, and then there's going to be, like, fire raining on your head. Like, it's terrible. You'd go through a period of being absolutely paralyzed by fear and horrified and, you know, hysterical, but then you couldn't think about that all the time, especially because you didn't know that it was absolutely going to happen. So I kind of just started to think about, like, what else are they doing? You know, what else are they doing in these 5 days? What are the things that are at the top of their list? And so that's how I had to have them think about death and also think about death
for myself while writing. Otherwise, it would have just been, I wouldn't have ever written a word. It would have been horrifying.
I'm not sure where we are on time. Sorry about that. I guess we're, are we? We're still good? Okay. I'm actually ready to invite the audience for questions if,
cool,
if we're okay to go ahead with that.
I see a mic.
Let's do it.
Awesome. Thank you. And also, I just want to say that I love David Tennant. He's the prettiest of the doctors.
Yeah.
But I think Matt Smith is a better actor. So, sorry.
Oh.
But I actually have a question, too.
We can all get along, guys. We can all get along. Okay. We'll see. It's in okay. November. We'll see.
Oh, yeah. We will.
Yeah. Head to head. We'll
Looking
see.
Forward to it. I do have a question, actually. I'm sorry. I just wanted to say, apparently the Hugo Awards, the science fiction awards, fan awards actually, are planning on, or might maybe one day add a YA category. Would you be interested in that? What are your thoughts?
Oh my goodness, every year they like vote on it and like it hasn't passed yet and it's so frustrating to me. I'm like, come on guys, like recognize us. Like we're kind of like dominating sci-fi now. Come on, they can't ignore us for much longer, I really don't think. I really hope that they pass it and start to do that. I think it would be fantastic.
It's funny that there hasn't been one.
I don't think it's actually gone to a vote, has it?
It.
I think they talk about it.
Is
but
that where? I don't
yeah,
know. I know
it's
last
a complicated
year it came really
process.
Close.
I know.
And
I
then
know.
It just missed. I was like, oh.
Yeah. Yeah. They'll get around
they'll
to
get
it.
They'll get there. That would be great.
I know nothing about that.
Hi. So I read a lot of books across various genres, and one of the things that has been I've been reading a lot more of is new adult, this new adult genre. So I'm interested to know your thoughts on, you know, sexuality in the YA genre and that line. How do you sort of distinguish what's appropriate or too much? Because as a teen, I have a 15-year-old niece, and sexuality is a big part of her life, you know? So I'm interested to know your thoughts on that.
I actually also don't know much about the new adult thing, but I gather, mostly from your question, that it is a, that it has, I think there are other things that differentiate,
the characters
right?
tend to be a little bit older, like probably college, 19, just about to enter college age, maybe, you know, mid-20s.
Right. I'm always curious about it as a genre because I feel like, it's just such a small, my characters are all 17, and then, you know, to have a whole other genre for a 19-year-old seems silly, but the sexuality is definitely a huge issue, and it was a big concern for me because I was writing about the end of the world and teenagers, and so
what's gonna
there was
happen?
No skirting around it. We were going to have to face it head on. But it was interesting because I had the three characters to sort of see how it was going to fit in, and it did play a role in each of the characters' stories, but to try to see how it was going to fit in. And to be honest, I think I was really relieved to have that sort of the end of the world thing so that I knew that people weren't going to freak out if I did go there a little bit because, come on, there's no way you're not going to. So it was nice to have that excuse to just be like, it's the end of the world. Give them a break. They can do whatever they want. But yeah, it is. I have two other books called. One was called Wish, and the second was Wishful Thinking under my maiden name. And I ran into the problem with that. And I think you just it depends. It always depends on the story and the characters. And you have. I feel funny generalizing that like all 17-year-olds will be having sex in all of the books, and that's just the way it is for young adults. I think it really is just what's appropriate for each story and character.
Yeah, Starters is 12 and up, so it's considered a clean read. And when I figured out how I was going to tell that story, I knew the boundaries. I knew where I wanted it to go and what I didn't want to cover. But I have a funny story for you, because when I was at Comic-Con, I was at Comic-Con this year, but the year before, I was on a panel with Michael Grant, Paolo Bacigalupi, who wrote a wonderful book, Shipbreaker, and some other YA authors. And Paolo has a wild sense of humor. So we all went out to dinner after our panel, and he said, I think we should write, meaning the authors of the table, a send-up of my book, like fan fiction, online, and it'll be in the style of 50 Shades of Grey, and we're going to call it Start Me Up. So
is this happening?
Yeah. So when is it out?
What's the URL? Can I read it? I'd kill him if he did it. So thank God he's too busy.
I think, yeah, it's a book-by-book basis. For me personally, my books tend to be pretty clean, like Origins of Scholastic Book Club book, which you have to be like super clean for that. There are two reasons, you know, my characters don't ever really like cross the line in my books. And that's one is all of my books so far take place in a very, very tight schedule. Like, Origin takes place like maybe 2 weeks max. Vitro takes place in like just less than a week. So there's not really time, you know?
Unless it's the end of the world. Then there's
unless it's the end of the world, which, you know, unfortunately I did not have that to go on. So it's a very, you know, my books are a lot more focused on the action and stuff and a little bit less on the romance side. Not in Origin, but in Vitro, it's a little less romance. And also, when I write, I have a 10-year-old baby sister whom I adore completely. And she's my ideal reader, and a lot of authors like have the person they're always writing for to kind of clear out all the other voices. Like instead of thinking, okay, all the people who are going to read this book, I think, okay, this is the person I'm writing towards. Even though I'm writing YA, she reads like all these giant fat books, so because she's awesome. So when I'm writing, I'm like, you know, if she can't read this, I'm not going to put it in there because she's my ideal reader, and she's the person who inspires me. And so that's another reason mine generally don't go that far. But you know, I'm not against NYA. I think it needs to happen. It's a huge part of teenagers' lives. And as far as new adult goes, I kind of agree with you. Like, I think that it's just adult because they're adults.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe it's like extended adolescence or something. Like, we're teenagers, so we're 30 or something. I don't know. Or maybe, I don't know. Yeah. I think that in YA, it's a book-by-book basis. It's a character-by-character basis. You don't just put it in there for a reaction or because you think it's going to get more readers or something like that. It has to be true. And you have to take it, I mean, by character-character basis. So,
yeah, that makes sense. As a librarian and doing collection development, I'm curious to see, like, is this going to be something that's hanging on or is this sort of a fad? Because really... Mm-hmm. Before New Adult, like, kids who wanted to have books with a bit of a racier scene, like, there were books to find that would provide that. So, yeah, it doesn't feel especially necessary, exactly, but, yeah.
Since it's coming up soon, what are your thoughts on NaMo? Because I know that some authors love it, and some authors...
NaNoWriMo?
Yes.
I think it's a great idea. I think it's, you know, it helps a lot of people. I don't think it's for everybody's writing style. I have yet to actually complete it. Just because it always comes at the exact, like, wrong time in my writing schedule. Like, oh, I've just, you know, I've already finished a book and I'm in the editing stage. And how do you do NaNo when you're editing?
Can I just interrupt because my mom doesn't know what it is. Oh. It's National Novel Writing Month.
Thank you.
It's
like
it starts in 2 weeks,
yeah.
Right? November 1st. Anybody out there writing?
Yeah.
How many NaNo?
Good job.
That's awesome. I do try, like, say I'm going to do it every year. Has anybody here finished it? Yay! Hi. For you guys. Wow. That's super impressive.
I was just talking to Marissa Meyer, author of The Scarlet and Cinder and all those amazing sci-fi books, and she is a big NaNo fanatic, mm-hmm. and I just told her that I would do it for the first time this year.
Yay.
We'll see how it goes. Yeah.
Good luck.
Yes, she will hold me accountable. I know, I'm terrified. But I think it'll be good, because I think it's totally about timing. Like, it just happens to be happening when I really need to get a lot done, and I need as many external deadlines as I can possibly get, so I think that'll be great.
My whole life has been NaNo.
Hello. You mentioned just now that maybe new adult is kind of a fad. I read recently that a bunch of publishing agents think that young adult, period, is a fad, and that over time it'll disappear along with dystopia or trilogies or paranormal or something. And I wanted to know what you thought as young adult authors.
Are you talking about that one where Josh Adams was one of the agents and they were just, it was in about the last week, maybe, and it was all over the internet?
Yeah. Oh, I didn't see it.
Right. Yes, okay. Yeah, I wouldn't take away from that he said it was a fad, and I know him. and it will disappear. I think the gist of that was that there's been this big balloon, like in real estate, in YA in the last few years, and the balloon is starting. You know, it used to be if you had a YA manuscript, 3 years ago, you know, everybody wanted to jump on it. Because there's been so many adult authors who suddenly jumped over to YA, there's like a kind of a glut on the market of that. And that was pretty much what I got from that. So I don't think YA is, Josh would not say YA is going anywhere. He reps some great authors, and that's his livelihood. But I do think it's a time for a new writer just to be absolutely sure that's what they want to write. And then you have to go for it. Absolutely, go for it. But make it the best work you can do before you start sending it out to agents. Make sure your writing group has looked at it and everybody says, yes, this is it. Go and start querying.
Don't just count on the craze to get your novel sold.
Right. That's it.
Don't think everybody's buying YA, so obviously it's going to sell. Not necessarily true.
Oh, yeah, I was just thinking about what you're saying about the writing process. One thing that I think is so great about the young adult writing community, it seems like, and part of it is because social media has just exploded along with but there is a real shared community of writers. I think traditionally writers have been a little more solitary in their writing, and it seems like that is something that is very positive and awesome that, you know, people do really support each other and promote each other's work and share with each other the whole process. A lot more than...
Definitely true. Yeah.
Yeah. So I have a question about sort of creating a world or modifying an existing world, as the case may be. What would you say was your greatest challenge in coming up with something new or trying to modify Martha's Vineyard or et cetera?
The greatest challenge. I think one thing that's hard about taking a world, not only like a world that exists, but one that you really live in, is that... you just constantly, I just felt such pressure to get it right. You know, like, I mean, on the one hand, there's like all my friends who I know are going to read it, and I just want to make sure that it's right for them. But I also, you know, you want to present, I wanted to say, it was really a lot of imagining what would happen. This is my home. What would we be like here if something this terrible was really going to happen? And at the same time, you don't want to paint it all rosy and, you know, everybody would be so wonderful and it would be perfect because that would be a really boring book. So, you know, you have to be honest. But it's hard. I think sometimes I'm envious and, you know, curious about more sort of true science fiction world building because you can just sort of, I mean, there are certainly rules, but you create the rules. And it's a lot to feel sort of beholden to an actual town, and especially when it's one that you live in and have to go to the grocery store every day.
Yeah, I also wrote about Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. I live in Los Angeles. For me, I never... once I got the idea of the world, the high concept that I gave you guys, I never sat down and said, okay, so, you know, what would it be like? What's this? What's that? I got into the story and the characters, and as each thing would come up, oh, I've got to take her to the music center, then it was like, well, how would that be different in the near future? So it was kind of on a case-by-case need basis, did I build up this world? And I think that's important, that it be organic, that it be true to the story, as instead of superimposed onto your story.
I do not live in the Amazon rainforest, much as I wish I did. So for me, the world building was a huge, huge part of the story because I'd never been there. And I had to completely immerse myself in that world. And to do that, I mean, I did all the different weird kind of research I could do. I went to the bookstore and I bought like every single picture book about the Amazon that I could find, and I just constantly was paging through them and just kind of soaking up the images. I was pinning everything onto Pinterest. Like, I'm a Pinterest nerd. Like, Pinterest is my thing. Okay, so look me up if you're a pinner, because we can talk. And I'd have these long boards on Pinterest of just rainforest things. Wikipedia was perpetually open. Not that that's the most scholarly source, but I just use it a lot. perpetually open while I was writing. I even got Sounds of the Rainforest, like CD tracks. And I would like just start playing those, and I turn off the lights, and I just like okay, rainforest mode, rainforest mode, and I just listen. And that really actually was very helpful in getting into the mood and imagining the rainforest around me. I watched a lot of documentaries and just read books and read books and read books about the Amazon until like I was just dreaming about it. I probably did 2 hours of research for every hour I actually spent writing the book itself, because it was so important to me that the world be real and that you could be able just to sink into it and imagine, you know, the giant kapok trees and the vines and the animals and the sounds and the moisture and the heat and the humidity. I just wanted the readers to be able to be as immersed in the world as I was. And so it was a very important part to me, and I spent a lot of time on it. I did not go to the Amazon for research. If I had known then that the book would sell, I probably would have been more motivated to make the investment, but I had no idea at that point, so I was like, oh, that'd be kind of crazy to go. Now I do go on research trips for the places I write, because it's so much more helpful, because generally I don't write places where I've been before, because it gives me an excuse to learn about somewhere new, which I really enjoy, because I love traveling. Great question.
Hey, guys. Hi, Jess. I've been following your blog since before you got an agent.
So oh, wow.
It's been really great to see your journey. Yeah. There's so much YA out there today. I guess I was wondering if you guys had a book that you'd recommend we read. Probably something that we could maybe find in a bookstore, you know, so not from like the 80s or 90s.
There's so, so many.
I'll go since yes. Maybe, I don't know if you are, I mean, I'm not going to have any amazing science fiction recommendations for you because I am probably the least well-read in the science fiction genre up here, but I will tell you that I have just finished a huge Sarah Zarr binge reading. I love everything she's written. She's amazing. Story of a Girl is so incredible. I highly recommend it and all of her books.
I just blurbed a book that'll be coming out in late January, and the author's name is John Dixon, so remember that, John Dixon. This might be easier for you to remember. There's a TV show that'll be coming out at the same time called Intelligence. Okay, so his book, which is a different title, and it slips me now because it's a different title, is based. The TV show is based on his book. So, and the cover, you'll remember, because it's like this big guy's fist with like sort of vines coming.
What's the name of the TV show?
Intelligence.
Oh, you said that.
That's okay. So
I'm trying to put all pieces together.
Just remember the author John Dixon and that TV show.
That sounds interesting.
Yeah.
When it comes to sci-fi, oh my goodness. Okay, this is a little bit older, but you will find it in bookstores. Lois McMaster Bujold is my number one favorite fantasy writer. She's won more Hugos and like Nebulas than any other female sci-fi writer. She's brilliant. She's a genius. I just want to like lock her up in a room and ask her millions of questions about how she writes these amazing books. And so definitely look her up if you're really into like hardcore sci-fi. Also, there are a couple really great new sci-fi books coming out. Control by Lydia King. I had the pleasure of endorsing that book. And it's a very sci-fi, cool book set in the future. And then, what's the name of that other one? Oh, I just finished reading a new book coming out called The Winner's Curse by Marie Rakowski. Look that up. It's very good. It's not sci-fi, but it's very good. So,
I've got a couple. They're a little older, although one has a sequel coming out. Actually, I think probably both have sequels coming out. One is The Pure by Juliana Baggett, if you haven't read that yet. Oh, my goodness. It's fantastic. And then the other one is, I think, technically science fiction because it happens in space on a spaceship, but it's very funny. It's called Mothership, and it involves a lot of expectant teen mothers on a colony in outer space who have to fight aliens.
Oh, love it.
So,
that's great.
Just when you think it's all been done, something else comes.
Do we have another question back there?
If not, we can keep giving out book recommendations.
Somebody's right here.
I can shout.
Posterity.
Hi. My question was actually a little bit similar to the one she just asked, but I used to be a bookseller, yay indies.
Yay.
And I wanted to ask you if each of you were a bookseller in a bookstore and you were about to sell your book, what are a couple of comp titles that you would share, you would sell along with your book?
Hmm.
Oh, that's such a good question.
If it's an adult, I would say State of Wonder by Ann Patchett, because it's in the Amazon. It has to do with, like, science. And I actually read that book only just a few months ago, and I fell in love with it. It was beautiful. And I was on the Amazon, and I'm like, yay! So that's a really great one. Another one would be... Oh, I just had it. Starters by a lady named Lisa Price. That's great. That's so actually, I do have that on my blog. Like, if you like Origin, you'll like. I think that's one of the ones
terrific.
On there. There's a lot of great new sci-fis coming out, but... yeah, that's all I've got right now.
It's really hard. It's really hard because I my book is so in that weird between zone, and I'm not sure. I'm sure there are tons that are like that. I just don't know any. I would say watch the movie Seeking a Friend for the End of the World, starring Steve Carell and Keira Knightley. that's pretty much all I have.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question that I've never heard before.
Yeah.
When I talk to schools, I have a PowerPoint presentation, and one of the slides is my inspirations, and they're books that I liked, but I wouldn't necessarily, you know, right. I mean, I love the Robin Wasserman series, for example, but actually movies, I have movies up there too. So if you liked Matrix and you liked Inception, then you're probably my kind of person. You know,
movies are a good place to go.
Yeah, yeah.
Michael Crichton is another one. A lot of people tell me they're like, "Oh, it's like Michael Crichton."
That would be good.
It's okay, I love Jurassic Park.
Yeah,
there's no dinosaurs in it. No. Sadly, dang it.
Next time. Immortal dinosaurs.
I really missed out. Immortal dinosaurs. Copyright Jessica Corey. I'm watching you. Don't be shy.
You're going to think of that question like when you're driving home or on the train.
So, what do you, why did you want to write in the first place? So, why did you become a writer?
I decided to be a writer when I was 4 years old. And that's because the first book I ever read was called Danny and the Dinosaur by Sid Hoff. Anybody know it?
Yeah.
Okay, Sid Hoff is amazing. And Danny and the Dinosaur, when I was a kid, I was absolutely obsessed with dinosaurs. Like, I watched Jurassic Park on repeat every day. When I was four, I don't know what my parents were thinking, but I loved it. I used to go into my preschool class, and, like, they had these dinosaur toys, and I would, like, hoard them. And if the other kids came close, I would try to bite them. So the book, like, really spoke to me on a deep, deep level. So Danny and the Dinosaur, I read the book, and it's about a little boy who goes to the Museum of Natural History. There's a dinosaur on display. It comes to life, and they go outside, and they play and have adventures. But at the end of the day, the dinosaur has to go back to the museum and goes back to being a lifeless exhibit. And that broke my heart. Because, like, this book is so amazing. And then I get to the end, and, like, Danny's walking home, and he's, like, sad and slumped over because his dinosaur friend is, like, gone, essentially dead. And it really tore me up. So I was so mad, I decided to write my own sequel, or own version of Danny the Dinosaur. And I went to preschool the next day, and I ripped out some pages from my preschool notebook, and I wrote, like, a 4-page story called Danny and the Building Blocks. And in the story, it was Danny and the dinosaur built a tower of blocks, and then they fell over, and that was the end. It was riveting stuff. Needless to say, it has not been published. But I stapled it together. I made, like, all the kids in my classroom read it, and... I was such a bully.
That's great.
That's like, when
you
were
your own
author,
you were your own PR team.
Yeah, I was. Right. I was like, you will read this book. my preschool teacher actually still has it. She told me. Anyway, from that moment on.
Do you make her read it to the classes that you
I don't. Says? No. I learned, I became wiser. It's like, they actually have to want to read it. So that was my first experience with writing. And ever since then, I just knew that that was it. That was the thing for me. And so it was a lifelong dream come true when Origin finally came out. So it was hard for me to believe at first that this thing I'd been wanting my entire life had finally come true. And it all started with 4-year-old fan fiction, so...
Wow.
Don't discount what you're doing now, whatever it is. Just, you know, it's a starting point.
Yeah, it's really true. I was also a born writer, writing short stories. I have one when I was 8, because for some reason, I put my age at the top, you know. Yeah. But that doesn't mean, you know, you couldn't be a writer at any time. You just have to really want to do it. That's it.
Yeah, I mean, I have sort of similar stories. I always loved writing. When I was really young, my dad and I, who's here, would write stories, and he would write a chapter, and I would write a chapter. And we'd go back and forth. It is so cute. We still have them. They're, I think they're about like a dove, or I don't know. They're really fantastical, and they're actually probably the most similar to the books I write now than anything I would write from then on. Because after that, I got really into playwriting, and I wrote a lot of plays and screenplays and that kind of thing. So when I came back to writing books, it just sort of all fell into place, and I didn't even... it wasn't something... I didn't realize that you could actually write books and make a living. I had no idea. So it was a very... happy realization and discovery that I found my place in the world that way. But I had always loved writing in one form or another, and sort of just followed it to this place.
So was your dad a writer?
He is, yeah, he is a writer. He is many things, but he has done a lot of writing, yes. He always fostered a love of writing for all
of us. Lucky you.
Yes, I was very lucky.
I was just wondering, with everything that happens in life, when you're trying to write, be a writer, with family, full-time jobs before any of the writing takes off, how did you manage your time with your writing? How did you not get so frustrated that, trying between the editing part of it and trying to get things moving with queries and stuff like that? Just curious.
For me, I had a really great support network. And that's a really important thing. You know, my family was 100% behind me. Like, they'd been listening to me whine about writing since I was 4 years old, so they knew. They're like, yes, Jessica, yes, go write. But, you know, I really had a lot of support from my parents where they would let me. I was homeschooled in middle and high school, and they would let me finish my work in 2 hours in the morning and spend the rest of the day in my room writing. And that really helped foster that love and that support. So I felt like I could do it, and it was a good thing. And then after I got married, my husband would often take on a lot of the extra chores. He would do the cooking and the laundry and stuff to give me extra time to write because I was also working at the time. And that was, you know, the main reason I got to write Origin was because he was, you know, willing to make the sacrifices to support my dream. And just, it's beautiful to have that support of the people around you. And, you know, if you don't have it, it's very difficult. But I think one of the beautiful things is that with the online media, like you're saying earlier, it's easier to find that and to reach out to people who can encourage you. So it's really important to find those friends, find connections, even if they're just online, of people who can challenge you and encourage you and push you and help you meet your goals.
Yeah, in my case, my husband and I sort of switch roles. So at the time, he had a job, and I was getting to have all the time to write, but then I'd be a support system to him and, you know, cook and do all those things. He lost his job at one point, which turned out to be a really good thing because it kind of made me write for my life at that point. And suddenly, after, you know, some years of, you know, almost, the manuscripts that went with an agent went out but didn't get bought. I had two of those. Suddenly, I write starters, and everything happened like magic. I mean, it happened like in 24 hours, three agents, you know. In 6 days over holiday weekend, the manuscript sold in a preemptive bid before an auction. It was like when you, but I've had my time of struggling and waiting and wanting. Lee Child said something to me once that made a lot of sense. He said, getting the agent is procedural. And so what that means is, you know, you do your best work at home. You write the best manuscript you can, and you be hard on it and get yourself hard critics and rewrite it. When it's time for the agent, all you have to do is subscribe to Publishers Marketplace online and look at all the agents, see who's representing the kind of work you want to put out, and you write a great query email, and you can look online to learn how to do that, and you take your first 5 pages of your manuscript and you embed it in the body of that email. Don't put it as an attachment, right? Even if they don't ask for it, you just give it to them. And you have this nice letter. It's very professional. And you will hear back from them if they're interested. And they don't know if you're 14, It doesn't matter. Don't say I'm 14, right? Just be professional. Because, you know, some authors like Aragon, you know, got published that young. And so it's just a process. And there's a lot of writers who had, you know, Stephen King, you know, children and pressures and stuff. And you just, he literally wrote in a bathroom for a while, you know. So you, whatever it is, you just make it happen for yourself. And if you keep on at it every single day, you'll get there.
Yeah, I agree with all that. I think also there's a practical, you know, if you're out of high school and you're trying to write, or you're out of college and you're trying to write, you're probably going to need a job. And I think it's really interesting to sort of think about what kind of a job you're going to get. I mean, some people are really lucky and they have a lot of things that they can do, and they can go into some profession and then just write at home at night. Or I know I have a friend who works in publishing, and she works crazy hours, and she works, and every Saturday is a writing day, and she just writes all day Saturday and goes to her, you know, more than 9-to-5 job every day. For me, I mean, I really can't do anything else. So this was pretty much it, and I just needed to make money. So I'm a firm believer in waitressing as a wonderful complement to writing. I think, I mean, it's not for everybody, obviously, but it was just great for me because I really enjoyed it. It was completely different. It used all the different thing, you know, like it could not have been more different from what I was doing every day. So, you know, I'd write during the day and go to work at night and was exhausted. But I think the most amazing part of it was that it was so social, and that it really was, you know, when I was interacting the most. And I think that really helped my writing. So I think it's nice to think about what can comp, if you're committed to writing 100% and you just, you know, you need to support yourself, think about what's going to help your writing and maybe not compete with it, because that's a tough question.
Having heard from so many wonderful authors over the years, like, there just is no one way to do it, and I don't think anyone should beat themselves up over not doing it a certain way or however long it's going to take. I mean, Juno Diaz, what, like 10 years between books, and they're all fantastic, you know, and it's not sweating it. how long it's going to take me to do it. So, yeah, whatever works.
Do you ever find yourself loosely basing your characters on people you know?
Yes.
All the time.
There's a little girl in Origin named Ami, and she's like 7 years old or something like that. Yeah, 7. I do know my characters. But she's based on one of my other sisters who was also 7 at the time I wrote the book. And there's actually a scene in Origin where Pia and Io are about to kiss, and then Ami like bursts in. It's like, oh, you're kissing, because that is exactly what happened to me one time. It was mortifying. So this is gonna be my first kiss, and there's like rainbows and sunshine and like bells going off, and then it's like, you're kissing. Oh. And it was, the moment was over. Anyway, yeah. I try not to base all my characters on real people, because I'm always like embarrassed. Like, what if they read it and know? And they know this is based on them. And then I get really nervous, and so I try not to do that. But I do steal some things sometimes and hope they won't find out.
I don't base characters on people, but I use their names as a thank you to them. So I know a Michael, and he's a very dear friend. And I know a Sarah. And then Emma is a girl in my book that I never met, but she was a little Canadian girl who was only, I think, 13 at the time, and she read an early manuscript. And she was my first young reader to, because like, is this working? Because I'm only hearing from adults, you know, at this stage, right? And so my Canadian friend found her, and she loved it. And she said, the more, I need more. So I knew it was working. I got to meet her this summer when I went to Nova Scotia, and now she's like 16, right? So she wasn't little the way I thought she'd be, but.
Yeah, I do the same thing with names. I try, I mean, I guess I do, steal like parts of different people. I guess I shouldn't say steal, but borrow. I give them back. parts of, you know, friends or little stories or quirks, that kind of thing. But, you know, you have to let your characters be their own people, obviously, or you'd be writing a different kind of book. But I do also do the same thing with the thank yous, with the names. I remember for my first book, Wish, I went out to a school. It takes place in San Francisco, and I went out there, and I visited a class, and I was just so impressed by these kids. They were like 15, and they were doing these amazing like adaptation theater writing, and they were just so smart. So I basically, and they all had the coolest names, so I stole all of their names, and I heard from them. They were pretty psyched, so that was cool.
This is going to be our last question.
What is the recommended word count for a debut fantasy YA novel?
It really varies. I mean, the rule of thumb is take as many words as you need to tell the story, but don't go too crazy. the sweet spot people will tell you is like between 60 and 100,000 words. Fantasy, you get a little more leeway because of the world building. You can go up to about 120. But I mean, it really depends on the story and what it takes to tell. If it's a really, really good story, then you can go 120 words or more, or 120,000, sorry.
Twitter.
you guys know what I mean. Yeah. Okay, you can go over 120,000, but if it's just fluff, it's not going to cut it. So make sure every word counts and is doing double duty. So, but the generally, I always aim between 80 and 100,000 for a manuscript, and I know that it's going to be fine. Less than 60, too short, in my opinion. But I like fat books, so.
Yeah, she summed it up.
Yeah.
Okay. Did you want to give a shout out for
thank you. Yes, I do.
Before we finish?
Thank you so much. So tomorrow, Monday, there's going to be a special announcement about starters. So those of you, I have bookmarks here for everybody. So be sure you get one from me, and then you can just click on the QR code, right, and find out about this, or if you follow me on Twitter or whatever. But don't forget, it's Monday, this announcement. You'll want to be part of that.
I'm really intrigued.
it has something to do with Ender, sort of, but and something with you winning something very big, okay?
A free flu
Super
inoculation.
Intrigued. Thank you.
Thank you so much. This was a wonderful discussion with all of you.
Thanks for the wonderful questions and
thank you.
Profound answers.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Again, our authors will all be available for signing. So please check out these books.
All right.
Sounds good.
Good.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.